You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment. You are about to see.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me once again for a very special episode of Treasury Cast are my pals and fellow podcasters, not necessarily in that order, Greg Arujo and Sean Ross. Hi, guys.
Wait, Sean again?
we always get, we're seriously like Laverne and Shirley. We get paired together. Everybody thinks we love each other, but behind the scenes...
And you have a crippling addiction to Coke and Pepsi.
milk and Pepsi. And it's, you know, they always pair us together, but secretly behind the scenes, we just can't stand each other.
I like to think of you as the Statler and Waldorf of the podcasting community, but I mean, you do, Sean.
Yeah, that hurts, but it hurts because it's true.
tough but fair. Yep.
As I said, this is a special episode in that it's a sequel to episode 58 of Treasury Cast, which we did last year, where Greg and Sean and I talked about the Marvel ads, the classic Marvel Treasury ads that they ran in the 70s and 80s. So, of course, that led to doing an episode on the DC ads. I mean, how can we not talk about DC ads? And I think we'll see in the gallery post, which you'll find accompanying this episode over on FireWaterPodcast.com, that kind of in keeping with the overall style of Marvel as compared to DC, the ads are more varied. We'll see that they didn't have, like, Marvel kind of had a format that they plugged their books into, whatever they were advertising, Hulk, Thor, Spider-Man. It's kind of the format. DC, of course, all over the place, which led to, I would say, higher highs and lower lows when it comes to the general sense of these ads. So again, everybody, you can look at the gallery post and we're going to go in the order that you're going to see them in the post. Before we start, guys, I just want to ask you, like, I was definitely more as a kid. I mean, I love Marvel comics. I loved all comics, but I was definitely more of a DC kid than a Marvel kid. And so these ads kind of loom a little larger in my imagination just because, you know, it was hard to find these treasuries, you know. Well, they didn't carry them at every store. And I know we talked about this in the last episode, but like, just to refresh everybody, like, I mean, Greg, we start with you. Were you slightly more a DC kid than a Marvel kid? Or all the same?
Well, 50-50 in terms of just the regular standard size comics, but I would only get DC treasuries. I don't, my parents would just purchase them wherever the heck they purchased them. I was never around when they purchased them. It was like, hey, here, kid, shut up. Here, have a giant size comic and go do, leave us alone or something along those lines. And it was always a DC treasury with the exception of one Marvel one, which happened to be the last Treasury comic I purchased when they were actually being released.
Which was that?
The Incredible Hulk one.
Oh, that's the Batman Hulk one. Okay,
I thought the one with the Hulk with the high evolutionary on counter.
Oh, the regular one. Okay, I was worried you got stuck with like the Smurfs or the Annie.
Oh no, or something like that. My brother would have had the Smurfs because he was more of a Smurf person. But no, they knew to keep that away as far away from me as possible.
Sean, what about you?
So I was always more of a Marvel kid growing up. Now, if you look at my collection, I probably have a pretty equivalent split of long boxes between Marvel and DC, but I don't know. I've always loved Marvel month to month more. I think DC hit, like, to borrow your phrase, over the course of decades, DC hits higher highs, but also lower lows. Like in my mind, DC, if you look at their output, they have more volumes that should end up in the Library of Congress, and also though more volumes that should be, you know, the bottom of bird cages. Like it's where Marvel's kind of down the middle, really, really solid. DC gets, you know, higher high, lower low. So I was a little bit more of a Marvel kid. But having said that and going through these ads, I mean, I loved, you know, everything we're about to talk about. As far as treasuries go, definitely I had more on the Marvel side. And again, kind of like Greg, they would just, I would find them at like a garage sale, or I mean, you know where the best place to find these was those Scholastic book sales they used to do?
Yeah.
They still do them, except they're way better organized now. Scholastic has more money than the average GDP of some small countries. I know this because I taught middle school, and those Scholastic people are like drug dealers, man. They will come to your class and they're like, hey, get your kids to order 3 copies of this and you'll get this for free, and get them to order this and you'll get this for free. And so you're like, you know, pushing their product. But it definitely, those Scholastic sales in the 80s, they would always have these bins of treasuries, and unfortunately with price tags on them, and the gods curse those that put price stickers on comics. Still, you know, it was a good place to get them.
I never had them at the Scholastic book fairs. It's funny. We had them. We had those. They never sold treasuries.
I purchased one when I was like second or third grade that had what was one of the early Superman ones. That's how I got it. Was that one I do know how I got. That was through a Scholastic order from that I managed to beg my parents and to spend in the money for.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
Jeez. Yeah, I got an early Fantastic Four treasury. My 2 prized possessions from Scholastic book fairs, an early Fantastic Four treasury and a bootleg Benny Hill tape that apparently my middle school did not know who Benny Hill was, or that they probably shouldn't be selling it to to middle school students, but
it's
loved it.
Yakety Sax in it. How can it be bad for children?
Can't go wrong with that.
Musical. There's a lot of kinesthetic movement. There's a lot, you know. Great. It's good.
It's educational.
Yeah, it's educational. Totally. So, oh my God. So, but both the insights to your childhoods are just sort of terrifying in their own ways, guys. But okay, that's an episode for your own show. We'll need to get into that in Treasury Cat. So, okay, let's start with the ads. Like I said, they're over in the gallery post accompanying this episode, which is episode 70. Of Treasure Cast. So let's start right at the very beginning. I'd say we're going to hit the ground running, which is the greatest Batman thriller of the decade ad. And it is the Batman Ra's al Ghul, Ra's al Ghul, whatever you want to say it, Treasury Edition. 4 classic Ra's al Ghul stories gathered into one giant novel by Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams, Irv Novik, and Dick Giordano, featuring that great Neil Adams cover, on sale May 5th. All right, boys, what do you think of this? Do you think of this ad?
I own this one, and then I don't even necessarily knew that it existed before I had it in my hands, but nevertheless, this thing was just like something from the gods. Calling it the greatest Batman thriller of the decade, normally I scoff at kind of like that kind of hyperbole, but I think it's warranted. The trim size of a tabloid, it is definitely well worth the $2 that they're asking for it.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, the cover alone is.
Alone. I remember of those stories. I you know, the last story of it, or the last couple stories, were burned into my brain. I think I probably disliked the first one, but I couldn't tell you why. But I just had this vague sense memory of like, skip to the fight in the desert at the end.
I mean, it's amazing, though, that I did not know that Ra's had this kind of pull even back then. Because to me, you know, he's a lower key, even though I guess, you know, he's the main villain of Batman 400, which is, the book that transitions Batman pre to post-crisis. But, the cover is just gorgeous. And, you know, Batman's, you know, over Robin's fallen body, and Ra's is in the sand seemingly laughing, and Talia's there, you know, beautiful and as ever. And I have to say, whenever you picture Ra's al Ghul, am I alone in this? Do you always picture him with his shirt off? Like, I swear to God, I cannot see him, even if he has a shirt on. It'd be like seeing George Hamilton without a tan. Like, I cannot see Ra's clothed. And so even though I know he's wearing clothing in this story, to me, he's just always walking around like sun's out, guns out. Like, I just think it's his natural state.
It's probably hard to, I mean, as you can see in the ad, to fully capture Neil Adams as like the sort of craft tint background that he had in Ra's al Ghul, because it looked kind of muddy here. But I can remember this ad, and I mean, just all the giant word balloons, and you know, yeah, the greatest Batman thriller of the decade. Yeah, maybe. You know,
I mean, it's not something. I mean, name something that's better, I guess, and I'd be hard pressed.
And I have a question for both of you. Is there a more underrated Batman artist than Irv Novik? Like, I love Novik's work. I love his Batman work. And whenever the list of all time underrated Batman artists come up, I don't even see. I mean, he's so underrated, he doesn't even make that list. Or I mean, are you guys fans of his stuff?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, I am now. Yeah, I liked it less when I was a kid, but now I have a much greater appreciation for it, especially his Batman stuff. And I think it's great that their names are so prominent on the ad. You know, I mean, that was still not that, you know, not that normal in 1978 for this,
particularly on a DC comic. I mean,
By the way, what is 4 to 6 weeks for delivery? 4 to 6 weeks, guys.
Yeah.
Come on, DC. What are we doing here?
Well, you got to figure it's going to, I don't think there's FedEx at this time. And, you know, obviously there's poor Alice in accounting has to make sure your check clears.
I guess so. Can you imagine some of the sticky money they probably got and like pennies and all sorts of stuff?
And do you think there was a little bit of a print on demand kind of thing? Maybe they did like a first crop of a couple hundred, that kind of, you know, or do you think to save money, they did lots? I can imagine, you know, for some of the less successful ones, they were just stuck. I mean, it was like on the last episode we did last year for Marvel, we were saying, like, you know, you buy one and you get a free copy and you're like, oh, that's the one that didn't sell. Like, yeah, right. You know, they threw it in.
I would imagine with that trim size that they're printing whatever their final print quantity, unless they have to go back for a reprint.
Yeah, I guess I could just feel like it as a kid. That would have felt like an eternity to me.
Oh,
although I was used to waiting 3 years in between Star Wars movies, so I guess I wasn't that bad.
Time did move differently, but I have to say, as somebody who did order stuff through the mail at times at that age, it was. I mean, it was a little bit like having amnesia. Like, you would just come home one day and you're like, "What's this?" And then you'd open it. It was as if, I mean, you've never seen it before, and, you know, just fell from the heavens. So that part was kind of cool.
Although, just the thought of this being mailed kind of makes me twitch a little bit.
Oh, you know, it was folded up and stuffed.
I had subscriptions at this time, and I know the condition of those subscriptions. I mean, it's fortunate that they were, you know, still legible. I mean, in one piece.
Well, and, you know, the poor dads of the world getting this brown paper wrapping coming in and thinking they're getting something else, and, you know,
yeah,
secreting away, opening it up, and being like, "What the hell is Ra's al Ghul?"
My kid spent $2 on this.
What, yeah, exactly.
So, it's a great ad. I mean, it's just one book. You don't need anything else to accompany it. So next up is another Batman ad. This one is for Batman's Strangest Cases, and 5 of the weirdest, most awesome Dark Knight detective thrillers ever published, 80 gigantic pages. And once again, they're giving some names: Adams, Giordano, Irv Novik. There he is once again. Denny O'Neill, Frank Robbins, Len Wein, and Bernie Wrightson. Now, the thing I love about this is that they have the splash pages for all 5 stories. I think that's a fun thing. And they monochromatic them. That's not a right word, but I just said it, in that they took all the color out.
Yeah.
Except the red and the deep Batman blue and everything on the Swamp Thing. There's a little bit of green there. But, like, that's a particular color choice, and it made this ad very distinctive because no other ad looks like this.
I have to kind of disagree. I kind of dislike this ad only because I know it looks muddy as all out. And it's really difficult to read, even though the titles are, you know, red and you can kind of read them. I don't think it's as effective as they think they are.
I like it. I think I had a tolerance, and I think we all did, a tolerance for newsprint back then, you know, just knowing that stuff was going to bleed and bleed through, and anytime they tried to photostat something, it wasn't going to come across. And I really like the little pops of color. I didn't realize is the first story is The Demon of Gotho's Mansion. Isn't that a guy that writes into your network a lot?
Yes.
I didn't know. That's so cool. I didn't know that was from a story. I was like, what an interesting name. Wait, but you have to remember, another podcaster on our network, his name is literally Gotham. So, you know, it didn't seem like such a stretch. Yeah. And so, I don't know. I like it. I like the little pops of color. I think it's cool. And then I like to think about his weirdest cases, because one of my favorite things about the Grant Morrison Batman run was that black casebook idea, was that every weird story, Silver Age, you know, every story that, you know, the Batman of Zur-En-Arr and all of those things, even though they seem like they were, conscripted to pre-crisis craziness, they all had happened, and that Batman is the kind of character who can have all these bizarre cases. So I think it's cool. I really like that. I think it's Batman lends himself to different milieus, and I think it shows.
I I don't know if these are probably the strangest cases, although of the five, it does have Swamp Thing in a trench coat, which is always welcome in anything that I read. You know, if it doesn't have giant typewriters or bat bite, I don't know if you can truly call it strangest cases.
True.
They're definitely borrowing from a very specific time frame because, I mean, the ones where Batman became a baby, that's probably his strangest case versus the Demon of Gotham's Mansion. But,
okay. I do love, though, I love that we get some Bernie Wrightson art in here. Mm-hmm. That's, that's
amazing. Mean, yeah, it does have a murderer's row of artists and writers, so.
I used to teach Frankenstein when I was still teaching ninth grade. And I used to bring in his illustrated version, and I would project his illustrations on the board. And man, my artsy kids went crazy. I think I told this story before, but one of my kind of kookier kids, who you know struggled through school, but I loved him and he did well in my class, went off, you know, graduated, came back to visit me years later, and had gotten a tattoo of actually one of Wrightson's Frankenstein drawings on his arm, really beautifully, elaborately done. And I was like, man, I'm like, I don't know if I should be flattered or if I should be, if I should apologize to your mother for impacting you like that. But I loved the idea of, you know, this one-off thing. Cause I used to, you know, when you teach, you try to hit multiple modalities, right? So you bring in art and you bring in music, you do everything you can, especially if you're teaching something like Frankenstein, which the kids at first think is dry. And then they come to understand the themes in it, and it's really cool. I mean, we talked about cloning and, you know, Dolly the sheep and all that stuff. And so you do anything you can to hook them, and you just never know what's going to stick. I mean, here was this one, you know, me geeking out on a comic book artist I love, and that was the thing that kid remembered years later. So I was like, cool, go Bernie Wrightson.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great. So, all right, so next up is a twofer, and this was an ad that was a double-page spread. So they were giving a lot of comic book real estate for this. The main part of the ad is the Bible, and then followed up with, I guess, a comparative book, Famous First Edition All-Star Comics number 3.
I mean, they're both Old Testament for both of them, I guess.
I mean, I would have thought maybe Rudolph or something, kind of a Christmassy thing.
Easter than
Yeah. I mean, the Bible ad is great. They try. Yeah. They make this look as exciting as it's possibly going to look with the word balloons and the only DC who can bring it to you. I mean, it is really exciting. And then at the bottom, it's like, oh yeah, there's also All-Star Comics. There's that one too. Yeah, that's good.
The Bible one is so awesome. First of all, they don't look like my people. Like, okay, so let's like, I just need to say up front, there is not a Semite in the bunch there. So, you know, but still, the art is, it's Joe Kubert, right? The art's amazing. Mm-hmm. But Moses is jacked. Like, Moses, this is the most amazing thing ever. Because, like, Moses doesn't just lead the people out of Egypt. He leads them on a fitness journey. He's like the Billy Blanks of the desert. And just, you know, it comes down from Sinai with the Ten Commandments. And the first one is like, don't skip leg day. He is jacked beyond all belief. It's amazing. And so I love this. I love this very like manly retelling of the Old Testament. It's pretty awesome. I'd love to get my hands on this. This is great.
I've never seen this out in the wild. And I don't know if I'd pick it up, but only because I just feel like this ad is all that I need.
Ah, it tells you everything you need to know.
Everything I need to know.
I loved it last year, and it's a good comic, but it's the Bible. You kind of know what you're getting, sort of, by getting into it.
It makes me wonder the editorial decision to put this on their publishing schedule. Was this part of a marketing? Were these going to Bible schools or what type of promotions going on to this is such an oddball that it just makes me wonder what the thinking was to do this.
Or did they get some sort of federal grant? Like, do you guys remember the 80s? The feds had given a grant to TV stations to show educational, you know, shows, and they were showing the Flintstones and the Jetsons as examples of like pre and future like history. And then the federal government came and they were like, no, we're not going to continue giving you money for that. I wonder about that too, because I was like, this is a really interesting choice to do. And actually, I was wrong. Kubert only does the cover.
Does the cover. Which is all you see here, right? Yeah, it's Nestor. The panels are by Nestor Redondo, who did the interior. But yeah, the cover is what's so striking about it. I mean,
oh my god!
Obviously, DC. There's some there's some like ongoing life to this because they reprinted this in a hardcover edition just a couple of years ago.
Well, Nestor Redondo is an amazing, amazing artist. I mean, I just I do love my my favorite of the like dynamic blurbs is 2 years of research and planning. Like one as a kid, I don't give a damn how long it took me to make this. Like talk about like how interesting is this? It's like five study sessions in the library. Like I don't care about that. And then two. What, really? 2 years of research in the making? You didn't just watch the Ten Commandments? Or like, you know, like you hadn't heard the story before? I mean, I just, you know, I could just imagine Sheldon Mayer, who wrote it, like turning the page and being like, oh my God, are they going to get out of Egypt? Like, oh my God, you know, like it's just, it's such a weird, what a weird thing to boast about on your sales pitch.
There was a sequel planned, but obviously sales did not justify the Bible 2, as it were, or whatever they were going to call it.
Bible 2.
Yeah, you know, but they were hoping they had big plans for it, but not so much. And then, like I said, about at the bottom, they just have the little famous first edition, like, oh yeah, that's also available as well if you want that.
Well, I mean, I think and it is funny that the sequel never aired because it's further proof of the Jewish roots of the comic industry. Like, what do you mean sequel? we finished the Torah. It's all we needed. We didn't need to go any further than that.
Yeah, we're good. but yeah, that is one. We talked about that on the episode. That is one jacked Moses. There's no
doubt. My God.
He looks like one of those old-timey weightlifter guys who's like 80 but like super veiny. And you're like, what the hell?
Well, you get those ads on, you know, on Facebook where it's like, I'm 70 and I take HGH. And
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
all like,
yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's crazy. God,
terrifying. So, okay. the next ad is one of their kind of omnibus ads where it's, did you miss any of these fantastic DC tabloids? And we've got a bunch of covers, Superman versus Muhammad Ali, The Legion of Superheroes, Batman Strangest Cases. There it is again. Superman versus Shazam, Superman versus Wonder Woman. And then tucked down at the bottom, Welcome Back, Cotter and Rudolph Summer Fun. So.
I tell you, yes, I did miss these when they first came out. And which ones I would purchase today? Rudolph and Welcome Back, Cotter, first and foremost.
So I have to ask, you guys are a few years older than me. I remember Welcome Back, Cotter in reruns, but I don't know if you guys remember. Was it that popular?
It was at its time in the top 20.
It was a big, big show. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, and you know, Travolta's was everywhere. I mean, this show and the combination of that and Saturday Night Fever and Grease. I mean,
it surprises me because you see these issues out in the wild. I've been in several discount. I mean, I know I own one of the Welcome Back, Cotter issues because I couldn't pass it up when I ran into it in a discount bin. But it just cracks me up every time because I'm like, that's the show? Like, not, you know, White Shadow. At least you could have had a game, you know, some action going on or something. I never knew that show was quite that popular. Though, that term, that stuff from it survives to this day. I had a teacher I used to work with, and she had a pretty rough class, and she used to call them her sweat hogs. So I was like, oh, okay, I guess that show permeated.
There was a toy line. I mean, it was big. It was a big, big – yeah, you would be surprised that it kind of had that much kind of like merch heft to it. But, you know, it was –
what a wonderful decade, too. To be Gabe Kaplan and be a sex symbol, like, oh, my God.
I know.
Wait, talking about living in the right era.
Wait, you don't think of him as a sex symbol? I mean, come on.
I mean, I think for some people maybe, but, you know, Gabe Kaplan, I just did the voice. There's a lot. He's basically the male Fran Drescher. Like, there just isn't.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love Mrs. Cotter. But and then, of course, everybody did. Marcia Strassman. Everybody loved her.
Yeah.
Okay, let me just ask you guys. So, like, let's say, this is the year is 1978, and your parents have given you, let's say, $5 to buy some treasuries off of this ad. What two were you going to buy? Not now, Greg, when you're realizing which ones are the harder ones to find. What would you have bought in 1978 with, say, $5? How would you spend it out of this list?
Honestly, Welcome Back, Cotter today and back then, and Superman Muhammad Ali, without a doubt.
Okay.
Yeah, I would have gone Legion. I love one of my first memories are those little paperback books they used to print.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it was Bantam or what, but there's a Legion one with Superboy. And mm-hmm. It's got all these reprint stories in black and white. And I read the cover off of that thing. So Legion would have had it for me. I mean, I think all kids feel this way. I always felt like I got more bang for my buck the more characters were in the book. And then I would have bought the Batman. I mean, I was a sucker for Batman 69, you know, 66 and all things Batman. So I would unfortunately would have passed on the ones that now today I would be all over the, you know, Superman, Muhammad Ali and the Superman Shazam.
All right. Fair enough. Okay. All right. So now the next ad is Flash. The biggest news in comics, Action Number One has sold for $1,800.
Wow,
the good old days, $1,800.
Unbelievable.
Exclusive. Now you can get an exact copy, parentheses, from cover to cover, can be yours in the DC's original super size for only $1. So obviously this is promoting the famous first edition of Action Comics Number One. Copy heavy. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of copy going on here. It mentions some of the other famous first editions. There's going to be the first Batman and Detective Comics, Wiz Comics, Sensation Comics, Batman Comics, first issue of Superman. And then it mentions this is the golden wraparound cover that protects your special mint copy. I mean, they are leaning into this hard.
Oh, hey, yeah. Those people that got the golden wrap are selling their copies right now on eBay for about $50.
That's true.
There you go. There you go. I mean, as an ad, it's not bad, but again, it's a lot of copy.
Do you remember the Comic Overstreet Guide? Is that what it was called, right? Yeah, the Overstreet Guide.
The price guides? Yeah.
Yeah, the price guides.
I love them. I have one on my shelf here.
Well, I remember that was the guy's name, right? Wasn't it like Dan Overstreet or something?
Bob
like that?
Overstreet.
Bob, okay.
Bob Overstreet.
And I remember reading in an article by him, I don't know where I read it when I was younger, and they were talking about, well, why'd you start this guide? And he was saying something like, well, when Action Comics, you know, number one sold for, and it was something like $100,000. He's like, I realized there was money, you know, in these old comics that I own, and I figured I'd establish, you know, the sort of setting of the price guides. And I remember being so blown away by that and telling my mom, you know, see, Mom, like, you keep telling me, you know, when are you going to outgrow comic books? And I was like, see, I'm like, this copy of Alpha Flight 33, you know, it's going to put me through college one day. And yeah, and it's crazy. And so this is just coincidental because I just happened to see this yesterday. I think it's Ultimate Fallout number 4, bizarre title, but it's the first appearance of Miles Morales, Spider-Man.
Oh, okay.
A copy of that just sold on eBay for like $47,000.
Oh, holy crap.
Yeah. Wow. And that comic's from like not that long ago, right? That's a modern comic.
That's nuts, though. I mean, come on. I mean,
that's
hey,
I mean, that's
if you can get it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you can get it, sure. I mean, why not? But
yeah.
But geez. I've got better things to spend that type of money on.
Yeah, is Action Number One still the most valuable comic? Has something surpassed it at this point? I haven't really kept
it. It kind of fluctuates every once in a while. Something will take its place, and then a few months later, there'll be the story that somebody bought one for like $500 million or something along. Okay.
Right. Wasn't it? I think the last time I saw the big ticket, like Sotheby's kind of thing, it was Amazing Fantasy 15. It was the first Spider-Man,
and really?
it was in the seven figures. It was like 13 mil, something crazy.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was something really insane. And I remember that was the last time it caught my attention. And I was like, oh my God. Imagine how many men of a certain age are like calling their, you know, the spirit of their deceased mothers and killing, you know, yelling at them for tossing their boxes of comics from the attic, you know, when they left home.
I know what I owned. And so, no, that I may have been able to order, Taco Bell or something.
In fact, my
daughter's already said with the comics that I've accumulated over the last few years that when I die, she's going to go promptly to Half Price Book, sell it, and buy a pizza. And maybe if she's lucky, she'll be able to get two toppings.
Things are rough over there at the Arujo house.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
Pretty cold. My goodness. Yeah, I mean, these famous first editions were very strange in that they were exact reprints, but they were at a larger size, which, you know, we've talked about this on the show when we've covered a famous first edition, didn't always do the artwork any favors because a lot of this artwork's pretty rough.
Yeah.
And then you blow it up even bigger and you're kind of like, what the heck? And then, of course, there was a whole raft of people that tried to sell these to unsuspecting kids.
Happens.
The outer cover ripped off and it's like, oh no, this is the original. And some kid thought he was getting Action Number One for a song. And it's like, no. it's just a reprint. So
it's the one print that you got with your peanut butter. I mean,
right. Yeah. So,
I do have to say one of my favorite little picadillos of comic book collecting is over the decades, at least three different creators have done a story about the guy in the bottom left
running away.
Yeah, with his hands on his head. I know Joe Casey did an issue about him, and I know over the decades, I have at least three stories about that poor schlub who's running away from Superman, destroying the car. It's great.
I think Bully had a Twitter thread that had all of them.
Oh, that's what it was. Yeah, there were many of them. So it's just, I mean, that you gotta love that about comic books. Like it's the only hobby that encourages you to go, hey, let's take a look at this. Whatever happened to the one guy?
What about that guy?
Yeah, what about him?
One thing it doesn't mention, and I mean, how could it? Because we've already got 16 blocks of text here. But there were Famous First Editions also released with hardcovers.
Oh,
nice. By Lyle Stewart. Those are very hard to find. I have a few of them, but they were pretty low print runs.
I had a teacher who had a couple of those in his classroom when I was back in high school.
Yeah, I never saw them advertised at all. And in fact, it was only due to the Overstreet guides, actually, you just mentioned, Sean, that I knew they even existed, because I remember looking them up and it said, you know, hardcover edition. And I was like, what? Did they do that? And I think, I know I've told the story on the show before, but forgive me, but when I was working at Borders Books, there was this change with the company where we had access to out of print titles. We were like partnering with some company and we could look them up. And if somebody was looking for a book that was out of print, we could maybe get it and get it for them. And I guess the idea was, you know, well, we're creating customer loyalty, getting them a book that Borders isn't really making any money out of, but it's a sale and whatever. And one day I was just at the register not doing anything because, you know, retail. And I was like, oh, I think I even looked up like Famous First Edition just because I thought, well, like they're books. And somebody had them, had like Action Number One. And I was like, can I just buy this? And they were selling it for like $10. I was like, this guy doesn't, whoever the seller is, he doesn't know what he's got.
Yeah.
Oh, so that moment, that brief window.
Yeah.
Nothing
exactly.
Quite like it.
So I buy it, right? And it comes in and it's the book. It's the hardcover edition of Action Number One. It's in good shape. And I'm like, and I was like, I wonder if he has more. And he had like five more of the other ones. And I bought them all because I was like, before somebody gets word to this guy, I got to get them all in. So I have Sensation Number One. I have the Action Number One. I have Detective 27. And they're all in hardcover with like the little Mylar sheets over the front. Like it's a, you know, like a paper, like it's a textbook or something. So, yeah. I mean, and other than that, there's no difference. It's just the hardcover.
And now you have that feeling like, oh my God, I got away with something.
I did.
That is awesome. I have to ask, of those copies you have, which one has the best art in it? I keep thinking probably what, H.G. Peter on Wonder Woman?
I have to, probably, yeah. I think just because his work is so strange and seeing it at a bigger size. Yeah, probably of all those, it's probably probably holds up the best of the ones at least they're talking about here. Now they would do a couple more. In fact, the very next ad is Famous First Edition number Superman number one, and here it says the most important comic ever published.
Yeah,
now in a 10x13 tub, it says what? Why is Superman number one the most important comic ever published? What are you talking about?
I mean, I was thinking about that too this afternoon. I'm thinking, is it because it's the first spinoff for Action?
Yeah,
I think it's just because they're claiming Superman is the most important character, but then, you know, Action Comics 1 is the most important comic. Yeah, it's or maybe they're just thumbing their nose at Fantastic Four. They're like, world's greatest comic magazine, huh?
Screw you, Stan.
I mean, when this was coming out, I mean, didn't this one come out right before the movie, the first Superman
right
movie?
During it, yeah, it was part of the big marketing push, and we'll see some ads later on about that too.
I have to say, I cannot see that cover and not think of the George Perez
homage his version
cover.
Of it, yeah.
Yeah, and which I, you know, and of course he just passed, unfortunately. By the way, Rob, huge shout out to you guys for your tribute episode. It was getting dusty while I was listening to it. I was like, my wife is like, are you tearing up listening to a podcast? And I was like, why don't you shut up?
Wow.
She did understand though, because I guess she goes, no, she was really. And I go, well, it's about George Perez. And actually, it's really cool. When he passed, I said, oh, I'm having a rough day. And she goes, well, I go, it's going to seem silly to you. I said, but my favorite comic book artist passed. And she was like, oh, George Perez. And I swear to God, I fell in love with her all over again. I did. I was like, oh my God, like for her to remember that is, you know, it's amazing. But I just think of that cover because I think Perez's version is so full of joy and I love it. I just think, it's unbelievable. not the most important comic book published, but, you know, maybe top 10.
Oh, definitely top 10. I would say that, but yeah. I mean, again, they were pushing Superman really hard.
I mean,
so what the hell?
You know, Street Poet Ray, Planetary. You know, there's a lot.
I was literally going to say Planetary.
Were you really?
Yes, I was literally going to say Planetary. Number two, by the way, not number one. Number two is a lot of big stuff and everything. By the way, if you look at the coupon, it says please allow 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah.
For delivery. So things are getting worse at the post office. Damn you, Louis DeJoy. I don't know why things are taking so long. But yeah, there you go. So Superman number one, the famous first edition cover. By the way, the trade dress for the famous first edition is now different. It looks a little more high-tech-y. It's the logo is reminiscent of the Superman credits. I don't know if that has anything to do with it.
Oh, I'm sure.
This is the only time they did it. This would be the last famous first edition they would ever do. Okay. So that was it.
I know we're moving at a fast pace, but I've got a couple questions for you guys. One, what's your favorite S emblem?
Wow. Grind the show to a halt, Sean.
Yeah.
I mean, I really do like that black background one. It's just like, I don't like black on Superman's uniform for any reason, but that... When I saw it in the one episode of Superman and Lois, I'd never seen it in live action. I was like, boy, that looks pretty damn spiffy.
It really did. Yeah, that's actually, it's funny. That's one of the reasons I'm asking. It had never been a favorite of mine. And then, who's the kid who plays Superman? Tyler something?
Hucklin?
Yeah. Like that? Yeah. I mean, one, that guy's going to make anything. Look, he's like not human. He's, I don't know, Olympian. But I was like, I saw that and I went, oh, wow, that is a damn good. That S is actually really cool. I mean, for me, it's still the Burn, you know, that era of S. But I do love the black one. I've come around to it.
Yeah, that's really spiffy. What about you, Greg?
I'm more of a kind of the Bronze Age, even the Burn era kind of classic. Red and yellow.
Mm. The two fish. Yeah. That's Bird called them, the two fish.
And then, sorry, one last one. Favorite Superman artist?
Oh, jeez. Oh, my God, Sean. I need time to think about that. What are you doing to me?
I mean, it depends upon the day of the week. Kurt Swan comes first and foremost. He's like the definitive Superman artist in my burned into my brain. Don't know if he's my favorite, but if he's what my brain defaults to.
I mean, Byrne for me draws the archetypal Superman. I'm a Schaffenberger guy. I love Schaffenberger. I'm going to go Schaffenberger over Swan, but for me, it's Byrne. It's always, anytime I picture Superman in my brain, it's Byrne.
I think I got to go with that. I think it's just because when I got in Superman, I mean, Dick Dillon kind of close just because I'm so familiar with him it's hard to answer because it's like, who's the most important to me? Byrne. But then I think, well, what's my favorite version? And that might be the Jose Luis Garcia Lopez Superman. Ooh, like, yeah. You know, praise be
the name.
Jurgens,
you
know? Yeah. You know, like, I guess when I think about, to me, what's the most iconic Superman? It's JLGL and the stock art stuff. Like, to me, that's Superman. That image is Superman. So, and Franklin's going to be really mad at me that I left out Kurt Swan, but I'm sorry. It is. So, okay, the next ad is kind of a strange one. Super Halloween. And it's a bunch of kids in their janky costumes.
Oh, they're terrible.
Batman, Superman, and ISIS. Interesting, ISIS. And then there's some masks, Creature, the Hunchback, a mummy, a ghoul or whatever it is. I can't even tell what it says. It's so dark. And then just thrown in on the right. Oh, yeah, you can get ghosts for $2.
There you go. Yeah, in case you want to read something.
Obviously, they had some extras at the in the warehouse.
Yep, yeah.
The there's two things. Can you literally feel your tongue hitting the slit of that Batman mask? the plastic cutout for the mouth and just
chopping your tongue to pieces? I can feel the rubber bands pinching at my ears.
That, and then the best part of this ad is that it says super safe flame retardant. Because, I mean, that's a huge danger on Halloween, is just lighting kids on fire.
Well, you got a kid wearing a Superman outfit. You Lord knows what mischief he may get into.
I like that the Superman costume comes with a domino mask.
It's exactly. Like, they can't even make these costumes look good in the art. Oh, they're terrible.
I love the ISIS, the little girl doing ISIS. She's doing like a walk like Egyptian thing. It's really funny. Yeah, the ghost thing is so funny to me that they were just like, oh, yeah, here's some. Because, like, this stuff isn't DC stuff.
No.
Like, this isn't anything you would have bought from DC. They didn't carry Halloween costumes. So it's kind of like, oh, yeah, also, I mean, this is a Heroes World ad, so that's why they do it. But it's just sort of funny that the ghost thing, and they don't even, like, do a blurb. It's just ghost $2.
Yeah. It's got the word ghost on it. They're like, just tack it in.
Done.
Do you think they got in any trouble for the Universal Monster ripoffs? I mean, the Creature, the Mummy, like, those are pretty...
I mean, the Mummy, Universal kind of can't do much on unless it looks exactly like Karloff. The Creature, uh-huh. though, that's theirs.
That's
straight up their character.
Looks like he's got a pretty decent 70s mustache.
He does, yeah. He actually does. Creature as like a 70s porn star.
I saw the Goof one. And I was like, I swear to God, I thought it was like a picture of my dad. I was like, what? I thought it was going to yell from the bathroom to have me bring it a beer or something. Like, it's a really intense image.
Was that what it says? Goof? I can't read it. It's so dark.
Yeah, it looks like it says Goof. Yeah.
Goof. Wow. Imagine being how exciting that had to be to go to Halloween as the Goof.
I would tell everybody I was Guy Gardner. I mean, look at the hair.
I'm sure if you really wanted it, it's probably still in stock.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I'm sure they had a lot of those laying around. But yeah.
Now with less asbestos or lead.
I ghosts. Okay. Ghosts. All right. And even on the little coupon, ghost book.
Yeah.
Man, I was hoping to get some actual ghosts.
Yeah. Oh, God. Oh, this is so
sad. The only thing I'd actually want from this ad is that copy of Ghosts.
I'd let that ISIS costume is pretty sweet, but it's probably worth a lot now. So, okay, more Halloween mischief is in the next ad for a fun-filled Halloween. The DC, the Masters of Mystery. That's a little much, I got to say. And they're pushing the House of Mystery Treasury Edition. Now, there's a weird kind of little background thing where in the back – there is a monochromatic House of Mystery cover by Bernie Wrightson, I believe. I think it's a Bernie Wrightson cover. But, like, that has nothing really to do with this ad. It's just an issue of House of Mystery. I mean, I think one of the stories from this issue is reprinted in the Treasury, but it doesn't say that. And so it's just kind of like, well, why is there just one? Like, I could see if there was going to be a bunch of covers in the background, but, like, one just feels like, okay, they had some space to fill.
Well, they're doing the size comparison, right? Because right above it says gigantic new super size. Yeah, I think that's what they're driving home is like
not exactly to scale, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Those covers are sweet, though. Man, the cover on this thing is awesome.
Oh, I'm looking at why and have to wonder why is it larger than the usual tabloid trim size? It's 10. Usually they were like 10 by 13, and I don't – this makes me wonder if retailers just went nuts because the thing was taking up more space than the usual.
Oh yeah,
the usual the tablets.
10 by
they couldn't put them in whatever racks that they had.
If you look at, I look at my DC Treasuries and they're not all exactly the same. Again, I'm sure the machine there's some varying there as much as they could. And some of the earlier ones are even a little bigger. And this is one of the early ones. So, yeah, I think they lopped off like a quarter inch off of these finally. I don't know why it would make a difference. But yeah, they did get a little smaller. And again, DC calling themselves the Masters of Mystery. That's a Stan Lee level, you know.
Oh, yeah. This is a great ad, though.
Yeah. And yet, you know, I don't think Marvel had any type of mystery type books. And maybe the only competition would be Charlton's at this time. So go for it.
Charlton, the masters of typeset dialogue. Okay, great. Yeah, super. Yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, yeah, Marvel wasn't exactly, you know, turning the horror mark. I mean, they had the monsters. That was maybe a little more something, but you're right. I mean, when I think of horror from the 70s, I think of Warren, but DC wasn't competing with Warren because that was kind of a separate thing anyway. So yeah, I mean, sure. Why not? What's going to happen?
You know? Do you think they blew the size up a little bit for like coloring book size? Cause look at the actual cover. They're talking less about the stories and more about the, like, how to draw a haunted house and, you know, cutouts and super pin. So I do wonder if they were trying to go for that. Hey, there are some stories that'll keep you up at night and your parents are going to be pissed that you got this, but also you can color a haunted house. Like, you know, it's trying to walk a weird line. Definitely.
Maybe so. Yeah, there were. And again, in the early treasuries, there were a lot more of like the interactive features, you know, a lot more puzzles, things you cut out later on. By the time they got to like Superman vs. Muhammad Ali, they dropped all that. But in this early thing, they were still doing things you could do and, you know, color and they do a, you know, crossword puzzles and things like that. So, but yeah, it's a solid ad. It really is a solid ad. It is.
Greg's favorite thing is when he gets a comic out of the discount bin and somebody cut out the Marvel stamp.
Mole Man, damn it.
I do like, though, that if you look at the bottom, it says receive your mint condition copy in a special crush-proof mailer. Like, I wonder if it was starting to – we're starting to get the DC, the companies realizing that these aren't disposable, that some people are actually holding on to these and collecting them. Because that's, you know, one of the rare times you see that even referenced.
Yeah, yeah.
Or conversely, there might be some people who were complaining that mine came in destroyed.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Please send me a replacement.
Yeah. Little known fact, those crush-proof mailers are the same material they make the black box out of in airplanes.
I was going to say, I know some postal carriers that would probably put that to the test.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Crush-proof, don't – challenge accepted.
That sounds like a dare.
So, yeah, I never got one of these in the mail, so I don't know what the crush-proof mailer was like. If any of you out there – got one of those in the crush-proof mailer, please let me know what that looked like. You know, I mean, what crush-proof? That's a bold bold statement. But again, DC's full of bold statements in this. Next up is the ad most determined to break your heart, and that is the half page coming soon in our all new super size. By the way, DC was really married to the super size term. They use that a lot. In our all new super size, a 4-part series, The Legend of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, by Jerry Conway, Nestor Redondo, and Joe Orlando. This was a treasury that would never see print because this project was never finished.
Oh.
Well, it says coming soon. It might be on a geological sense and not an actual.
Did they print any? Did they? Because it's just 4 parts. They didn't even print part one?
Well, okay, Greg, go ahead.
I thought I had read that there's art out there, but I don't think that there's a final printed version.
It was never finished. Pages of it showed up in The Amazing World of DC Comics.
Oh, okay.
The magazine.
Oh, I've got those. I need to check that.
Yeah, it's in there. It's not like, I don't think it's a full issue, but it's like some pages. And some of the original art has surfaced on the market. But this was originally meant to be a original treasury. And it's sad. If you read The Amazing World of DC Comics, I used to have a whole run of them. I don't have them anymore. But if you read it, you can track it, where you'll see it mentioned in one issue, right? And it's like coming soon, and you're like, oh, that's exciting. And then like 2 issues later of Amazing World, coming soon, you're like, okay, you're still saying coming soon. And then it's like next year, and you're like, well, we're getting further away from the horizon here as we're getting there. And then eventually they said, yeah, we're just not finishing it because DC eventually decided to scrap doing original treasuries. And it seems amazing to me. And, you know, we are friends with Jerry Conner. We've had him on our shows. He's a great guy, but I'm not going to bug him about this, but I'd love to know the fact that they paid Nestor Redondo for the work and to just scrap it seems like throwing money away. Like, let him finish it and publish it. Maybe you'd make some money that way. But no, it never happened.
I mean, it does say they could create it.
Yeah, that's true. I do have to say, I mean, you couldn't even repurpose the art. You couldn't have a, like, Hawkman and Hawk Girl travel back in time.
It's amazing.
I'd love to know the reason why it never came to be. Other than, I mean, repurpose it into put it in one of your horror titles or...
Yeah, a war comic. Do something with it, yeah.
And the art is gorgeous. What are you, either of you reminded of, like, Hal Foster and, like, Viking Prince? And,
totally.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, that must be what they're going for because the art is gorgeous. And I would have really liked to have seen this. I mean, I think this is an ad where I didn't realize it hadn't been printed. This is gorgeous. This is a series. The only thing that really struck me as strange, and it's kind of one of those little things where you can tell stuff was going wrong from the start, is if you look at the bottom, it says it lists the creators, and it lists Joe Orlando editor first.
Yeah.
Before Conway as writer and Redondo as artist. When did that ever happen? When is the editor ever listed on the any credits on an ad? And then two, when are they ever listed first? I mean, I know Joe Orlando is a great artist in his own right, but like, do you think that there was maybe some kind of weird power play there too?
Maybe he was just getting a Stan Lee on. I don't know.
Oh, there you go.
He might have been the one shepherding it. Like, you know, because, I mean, you know, this was not superheroes. You know, that's that was true. Probably a hard sell. Maybe this was like his pet project. And it didn't, you know, again,
what they should have done is a big blurb that said 3 years of research.
Yeah, exactly.
Screw you, exactly. Bible.
We did 3 years of research. It's Conway was unfortunately the victim of a lot of canceled treasuries because he also did the JLA three-parter with Rich Buckler that was meant to be an original treasury, and then that got scrapped. And now that did see print in JLA numbers 210 to 212. They just reprinted it as a casebook tale, which is why if you read those issues, they're kind of out of, you're like, wait, why are we going back in the past? Like, where's Firestorm and Zatanna? Well, because when the story was done, they weren't members. But that was originally done as a treasury. So I don't know what it is about Jerry Conway. Like, you know, he did Superman versus Spider-Man, so it wasn't like his stuff. But it just, that had to be frustrating to see these projects just get scrapped.
Well, maybe we can blame Jim Shooter on this one, too.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
When in doubt.
It's such a shame. And the fact that they were close enough to advertise it seems mm-hmm. crazy. Like, really? You're getting to the point where you're running ads for it?
I mean, really, if you've cut the check for it, I mean, accounting must have been just gnashing their teeth.
Well, and even look at the line work on the castle and the round table. Yeah. Like, I really wanted to see this. The art in this is gorgeous.
Beautiful. So, all right, next up is presenting the best of DC, which was from Best of DC number 52. Now, we're back to the splash pages with the colored logo. So, Greg, I know you're not a fan.
Not a fan. But I will say, of the six choices, I'm pleasantly surprised to see half of them aren't superheroes.
Mm-hmm. It's a very diverse lineup. Yep.
It is
and
a
that's,
diverse lineup.
That's one of the things when you asked a DC or Marvel kid. Yeah, the one thing I did love about DC was that they definitely had a diverse line and they weren't afraid to bring it out in these types of collections. I mean, half of my favorite things about the 100-page Giants wasn't necessarily the title story, but whatever was being reprinted in there, be it a Sea Devils or Roy Raymond TV Detective or something along those lines, something not Superman or Batman.
I love it mentions the creators, and it says Neil Adams, John Albano, Jim Aparo, John Broom, Joe Gella, Dick Giordano, Bob Haney, Carmine Infantito, George Klein, Joe Kubert, Denny O'Neill, Joe Orlando, Kurt Swan, and Alex Toth. Now, no offense to these gentlemen, but I'm sure this is the only time Jim, John Albano, and George Klein are ever going to get mentioned as a sales pitch for your comic book. They were not superstars that were moving the needle at all.
Other than this, John Albano's claim to fame is his cousin Lou, you know, who the great wrestler. And also just Alex Toth. I mean, you lead with Alex, right? You just. Alex goes first, I think.
Well, it's alphabetical. I mean, they're doing their, you know.
But, even alphabetically.
Oh, even so. You're saying anyway, I don't care. Yeah, okay. But yeah, I mean, that's a murderer's row of creators.
Oh, yeah.
There's the draw for this thing. I definitely question if these would be the best of DC Comics.
We covered this. Paul Kian and I covered it. This is one of my favorite treasuries. I remember buying this off the stand. Literally, I can remember where I bought it. A Woolworths in the Neshaminy Mall in Pennsylvania. I mean, I can literally have the sense memory of seeing it and picking up off the shelf. It's a strange collection because it's pulled from all these different eras of DC Comics. It's not like the best of 1978. It's just there's a Batman story from the 70s, and there's a House of Mystery story from 5 years ago, and there's the Dirty Job story from the 60s, and then there's like an early Flash 60s. Like, it's just, you know, like, wow, how did they pick these random six stories of the previous 40 years of publishing? But they did.
I was to say that I'd be interested in that decision and what may have almost made the cut.
They talk about that. There's an editorial and they talk about that, about the runner ups. And there was going to be a sequel. They even had a lineup, but they never did it. They another one that never saw print.
What was Dirty Job?
It is a, you really got to read it. It's a short story by Alex Toth. It's a story from the point of view of the Roman centurions that crucified Christ.
Oh, I remember listening to this episode. Yeah, that is fascinating.
It's from their point of view. Yeah.
That is really cool.
Amazing story. Amazing story. So yeah, I, as we've said, I like the splash pages thing, but I will say this probably isn't the best way to sell a great treasury because just seeing these images so small and so kind of spotty, it's a little, especially like Dirty Job, it's almost unreadable. It's mm-hmm. so dense at that size. And especially if they had a Neil Adams cover, I would think you would just go with that. You know, just grab the Neil Adams drawing yeah. and put that in your ad. So, okay, now we know Sean's going to love this one. This yep. battle follows the wedding of the 30th century in the all-new supersized, again, big with the supersized, Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, 72 pages by Paul Levitz and Mike Grell, special Legionnaires profile section by Paul Levitz and Jim Sherman. All right, so, Sean, what do you think of this ad?
I love this ad. I love this issue. I love it so much that I tried to convince my wife to let me do an open shirt wedding. she didn't go for it, thankfully. No, it is. I mean, this is such a great cover. It's such a great issue. You know, Lightning Lad, even though he's a total jerk in this era, and Saturn Girl are the rock on which the Legion is built. And this is such a great time capsule. And then the Grell Legion art is, I mean, it's like watching a really good episode of Buck Rogers, right? It like is just, it's awesome, but it's just sexual enough to be like, oh, okay, what are they wearing? What are you like? Oh, that goes all the way down to your navel gill. And it's really a great issue. It's a great story. And I love this ad. And I bought it, obviously, you know, secondhand. This was before my time. I bought it in a back issue dive, but it's still, every time I see this ad and this cover makes the like best of Legion covers all the time. It always makes me happy.
Oh, it's an amazing cover. The gatefold shot mm-hmm. of the Legion just tearing into all these people. So Greg, what do you think of this?
Oh, I think it looks great. I kind of like find myself more drawn to the wedding picture, wondering why, you know, Superman looks a little, a Superboy looks a little like his date stood him up or something for the wedding. And then, of course, you know, the Lightning Lad and Saturn Girl are all dressed up for the wedding. And, you know, all the other guys are in their work clothes.
They really did. They're all wearing Dickies. Like, they're all just – they just showed up right out of work.
I realize we've all come to accept the idea that when superheroes have a wedding, they show up in their costumes. But that's weird, right?
It is. Because
it's like if you were like on a football team and you went to one of your players' weddings, would you show up in your helmet and your shoulder pads? No, we're regular clothes.
And in the military, you at least have dress, you know, a dress yeah. version of
yeah.
your uniform.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, also it's kind of, you know, in the era of the spinner rack, it's amazing that this in continuity at the time, new story is there, and it's uh-huh. it's an important one. I mean, oh, I yeah. was lucky to find two issues in the same calendar year.
I do have to say, does Saturn Girl have Hanna-Barbera lower body? Like, is that Daphne or like? Oh, there's the thinness with which her legs connect at the bottom. It makes me, you know,
she's using her telepathy to alter the way you actually see her.
Oh, there you go. Right, she's part mermaid. It's pretty interesting, but I love this issue so much, and I love this era of the Legion, even though, like I said, you know, the way Levitz writes them at this point, Lightning Lad is such a jerk, and, you know, they're not necessarily the characters they would be later under his pen, but anytime you get Grell drawing the Legion, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, it's a nice ad. By the way, Greg, related to what you were saying about how hard it was in the newsstand days to get, you know, two issues in a row, it says here that this book is on sale around the first of the year. First of all, very casual. I like that around the first of the year. Yeah, let's not rush ourselves. First of the year. But then I looked it up on Mike's Amazing World. This came out on December 15th. Oh. So that means there were maybe two whole weeks where kids were missing it, not looking for it, because DC told them the wrong date. So, what the hell? Lots of Rudolphs here, but no Legion. What about? So next up is a curious twofer. The battle, nearly four decades in the making. Welcome back, Cotter. Wait, no. The battle is Superman versus Shazam, of course. An all-new 72-page tabloid thriller by Jerry Conway, Rich Buckler, and Dick Giordano. And then the first Welcome Back, Cotter tabloid edition. I love that first, suggesting uh-huh. there's going to be more. Again, of course, these were just the next two in the run. But I always found it funny that they paired these up as if well, they had kind of a similar audience.
Well, they both were television kids, stars.
I guess. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
Cotter and Shazam, you know, they each had their own television shows right around this time. This is well after the Shazam television series was canceled, but still.
Yeah. He's still a big star. Yeah.
It would be awesome, though, if there was another connection, if there was like a Jive Marvel, you know, because there's like Uncle Marvel and Bunny Marvel. If there was like a Sweat Hog Marvel.
That Sweat Hog Marvel. Yeah, there you go.
I love the Superman Shazam cover, though. I'm such a sucker for the Apollo Rocky both hit each other in the face at the same moment shot. And Superman looks pissed. Superman's like, whoa.
He fought everybody in the 70s. Wonder Woman, Muhammad Ali, Shazam, Rudolph. I mean, he just was getting in fights left and right. It was just amazing. So, but yeah, again, I realize these were just the next two in the run. They're not meant to be paired up exactly, but they just look funny to me that it was like, oh yeah, we can also get Welcome Back Cotter for $2. Okay, right, that's fine.
So they don't say who wrote the or drew the Welcome Back Cotter issue. Are they based on shows and they
it's reprints from the comic plus one okay. new story. So yeah, they had a lot of different credits there. So next up is again one of their kind of omnibus ones featuring kind of a dick move. It says, sorry, this issue is sold out. We have a limited supply of these other issues. Why are you even telling me about it then?
Well, it's either, you know, restat the existing ad that you have or which probably you get done for like a quarter of the price to have the advertising team put together a whole brand new one.
Yeah. No, obviously that's what it was. It was back then.
No, it's
you had to restat though. Things and, you know, you didn't want to bother, but it just seems so kind of like, why are you telling me you don't have it? Just don't.
Well, even better, it says, well, limited supply less. So if I ordered my copy of Shazam, the second one, and they're out of stock, am I just out of luck? I lost my buck 50. Am I going to be getting Rudolph in its place?
We're getting ghosts.
There you go. And a lot of those floating around. You know what they should have used is those old, remember the old Flash issues where Infantino would draw like a hand pointing you where to go in this panel? There should have just been one with the middle finger up. Like, you want Batman? Screw you, kid.
You had your chance. You had your Here's chance. The Bible, all right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Here's Rudolph and Moses. Suck it up.
DC did a bunch of these, a lot of these, like they highlighted one a bit that it was sold out, which I just felt like them just being jerks.
And at the same time, it puts it like, oh my God, I can't wait.
Right.
I got to get that. I got to get that Wiz Comics.
Very smart. Very smart. And these are, they talk about the crush proof mailer once again. So, all right. There's
a big selling point.
Big selling point. Next is for me, talk about, you know, mixed pairs, but nevertheless, to me, these are in some ways the ultimate DC treasuries. I had both of these. I bought them off the stands. I still have the same copies that I bought in 1977. These things have been with me for this long. People in my life have come and go, but but not the Super Friends at Dick Tracy treasuries. These will be in my my Viking funeral. They'll be on the ship with me, set aflame. I can't look at these as anything other than rose colored glasses. I love these two books, and I love that they're paired together.
Oh, they're both great. I mean, the Super Friends one is the best of the two Justice League ones by far.
Yeah.
So, and even setting aside the Alex Toth portion at the beginning of it, I mean, you got everybody cosplaying as Green Arrow in the first story, and the second one's got body horror going on in it.
I have to tell you, okay, I have a confession to make. This is hopefully a safe space. I have never read a single Dick Tracy story.
Oh.
My only experience with Dick Tracy is Warren Beatty and Madonna and Vogue.
There are easier ways to say you don't follow me on Twitter, man.
Well, no, actually, that's where I started. The only time I've read them is when you post them. That's it. That's all I've ever read. I don't know if I just missed it, if it was just because we're not too dissimilar in age, and you know, I don't know why I was a huge Sherlock Holmes fan. There's other, you know, stuff. Doc Savage, other things, but Dick Tracy just never.
Well, did
never
you read
did
the
it.
Paper as a kid? Did you read the comics?
Yeah, I mean actually Dick Tracy was never in my.
Oh, well, there you go. I mean, it wasn't around for you to see for the most part.
We had Amazing Spider-Man, you know, Family Circus, and then Family Circus Mean, because you know there's the two eras of Family Circus.
Right, and you know, sure.
Yeah, but no, I've never read a Dick Tracy story. So is this where I should start?
I mean, it's a pretty good.
It's a corker.
It always kind of boggled my mind why DC put together a Dick Tracy collection like this.
Well, I asked E. Nelson Bridwell, who was presumably he's uncredited, but presumably the editor of this edition. Of course, he's been gone a long time, so he's not. But so I reached out to I wrote an article about this for Back Issue Magazine, actually, because this is the one time DC ever did anything with Dick Tracy. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to Bob Rozakis, who, of course, you know, longtime DC staffer and the Answer Man, and was working at DC at the time. And he didn't have an exact answer, but he said, as far as he knew, he figured that Saul Harrison, then president of DC Comics, probably picked up the rights to do a Dick Tracy comic for like nothing. Mm-hmm. And was just like, let's just see what happens. And it was a giant flop. Like, it just sold nothing. That's why this is the one ever Dick Tracy appearance in a Batman, DC comic. Despite the fact that, you know, I mean, God, if they'd had the rights to it, man, they could have like had him and Batman team up. Like, it would have been amazing.
I don't know what I expected, but I picked this up. I found a really cheap copy a couple of years ago, and I think I was stunned that it was just reprints of the comic strip. Yep. I guess I thought that it was going to be just a straight up comic book story and not have the start and stop that the rhythm of the comic strips. I mean, it took me a second to get acclimated to it, but it was it took a moment, and it was
right.
That's an interesting choice.
Right. Adventure strips read differently when they're collected because, as you said, it's always beginning, middle, end. And if you're not used to that, now these are all the Sunday pages, I believe, is what they're.
But no, I think
the daily strips?
I think it was the daily strips. Okay. I'd have to go back and take a look.
Because they're all colored. I mean, they colored them, and I know that they cut pieces out because they had like subplots, and they cut all that because it's just limited to one story of Dick Tracy versus Flat Top. But I read this thing. I've read this thing a billion times. I absolutely love it. And we mentioned this in the episode that we did on the show back with our dear departed friend, Zumi Yukinori. But one of the most unusual things about the Dick Tracy Treasury, aside again from being the one time DC did it, was it shows up in the video for Rock the Casbah by the Clash. There's that scene where the guy carrying the boombox is running across the pool, and the three members of the Clash are hanging out at the pool, and Joe Strummer is reading this comic.
That's awesome.
Now you got to remember that video is 1982. This comic was 1976. So like, would did he just love that cut? Like, how did a 6-year-old comic end up in the video? But I remember just being like, that's the coolest thing ever. Cause like,
that is amazing.
The coolest thing ever. And he likes Dick Tracy. So
that's awesome. I do have to ask, having never read Dick Tracy and looking at this cover, does he just beat up anybody who's mildly physically different? Like, is it like, are you automatically a Dick Tracy villain if you have a unibrow or if you have male pattern baldness or it seems like the common thing amongst his villains is some sort of mild, like physical
deformity. Absolutely. Yeah, that's how it works. But man, yeah, this ad, this thing just gives me like all the feels just seeing these two books together and just like, oh, this is everything I want out of DC Treasury. But importantly, obviously didn't do a damn thing for Dick Tracy. So it didn't move any copies. Okay. Next up is an ad for a Treasury that everyone knows and was the exact opposite of Dick Tracy in terms of a seller. Superman versus Muhammad Ali, and they were smart enough to just say, let's get the Neil Adams drawing for the cover, put it on the ad, put some copy on it, and we're done, because what else do you need to sell this thing? This is one of the great images of Superman of all time. Mm-hmm. We just lost Neil Adams as well. It's been a rough year for comic book creators. But, I mean, this is just – I love everything about it. I also – you know what else I love? The Muhammad Ali logo.
Yeah.
I love they gave him his own – Who's Who-esque logo.
It's awesome.
Beautiful.
He definitely deserved an entry in Who's Who.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
An absurd comic. I love it for it, though. I mean, I would love to see a live action version of this.
Oh my God. Can you imagine? And they did a couple ads for this book. But using the same image both times. They knew, like, this is it. We don't need to do anything else.
I mean, here it is. Do you think the cover comes in and they look at it and they're just like, oh, I mean, this is what, one of the 10 most famous Superman images of all time?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And then the fact that, you know, and I didn't discover this till I was a little bit older, like probably like most people, the fact that literally the audience is populated with, you know, a who's who of folks. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It just makes it even more amazing that, you know, it gives you even more to stare at. And, you know, there's the keys you can find online to who's in the crowd. It's awesome.
I like somebody, that they let Batman be so close to Jimmy Carter. That seems...
Well, I was going to say, how would you like to be the person behind Batman?
Oh, I know. That would suck. It's probably Billy. It's probably Carter's brother. He's got some Billy beards, peanuts.
Down the front, please. Yeah, it's a great ad, and they just, again, they knew they didn't have to... I mean, there's still a lot of copy, but they knew to just take this drawing and put it, you know, center and just, like, clear out. Got to get out of the way. Now, of course... Sometimes DC had some extra space for, and then they, you know, they felt they could fit an advertisement. And at the bottom of some letters pages, there was a little banner strip ad. Where does Superman take on Muhammad Ali? ? Mm-hmm. Find out in December. I used to love those little things.
Okay.
I thought those were so charming that when they had like a quarter inch extra in the letters page, they just stuck in an ad there.
It's pretty cool. I mean, it's, you know, it's nice. But that Neil Adams cover is just, even, you know, we've all seen it a million times. It's still just as impressive.
Yep, completely. Next up, the phrase from the sublime to the ridiculous is but a step. We have a super celebration featuring Superman salutes the bicentennial. And if there was any ad that could get DC reported to the Better Business Bureau, it would be...
I don't know. I detect no lies in the copy.
Word tomahawk does not appear anywhere.
No, but it's featuring, and that italicized is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
It is.
But it's featuring George Washington and the men who made America great. Yes, there you go. Superman tells the story. He's at the top of every one of the damn stories in the Treasury, introducing it. So yes, he's telling these stories. There's no lies here. And of the two, I'll be honest, I prefer that one over the Justice League one.
Oh, that's just...
Justice League, even in 1976, when I read that one, I was kind of bored with it.
I don't even know how to respond. It'd be like going to see Hamilton and seeing a fourth grade class reenact the first Thanksgiving. Like, Superman Bicentennial is one of the great bait and switch moments.
Superman, you sit on a throne of lies. Sorry.
No.
Unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
As I say, I detect no lies in the copy. You're just inferring more than what's actually in it.
Does it say a tomahawk celebration? No, it says a super celebration. I think we know what they're trying to push here. Yeah. This show has taken a dark turn, and
granted, the Justice League one does feature Netflix star Dr. Destiny in the second story, but...
That Justice League one is awesome.
It is cover. It's worth it for the cover alone.
It is.
I will give it for the cover because, you know, it did inspire the Squadron Supreme number one cover. But of the two covers, yes, I will defer and say that the Justice League cover is better. But of the two right now, I will read the Superman Salutes of Bicentennial 9 out of 10 times.
Greg.
How are you doing? This is the hill in which I will die on.
Yes. Greg also bought Superman Salutes of Bicentennial for the Gallery of Presidential Portraits. Greg was like, I have not lived until I have seen Irv Novak's, you know, Hoover.
I want to learn what which order Millard Fillmore came in or whatever.
There you go.
All important.
There we go. So, okay, well, next up, that was just, again, the show just took a turn I didn't like. But all right, let's go to The Super Year is Here, 1979. Woo-hoo. And this was a themed ad where they're telling you, DC showing you all the various Superman comics you can get. And there's Superman Action, DC Comics Presents, Justice League, World's Finest, Super Friends, and Two Treasuries, the Famous First Edition, and the Superman the Movie. And then it even mentions the World's Greatest Superheroes comic strip as well. I really like this ad. I like the original artwork by, I think that's Ross Andrew, of Superman bursting through a calendar. Mm. Of course, this was the, you know, Superman's 40th, 78 was his 40th anniversary year. But 1979 is, why was 79 the super year? Why was it 79?
Well, you're right, the high of Superman, the motion picture, which would have just come out.
I guess. It came out in December of 78. So I guess they were just, it wasn't much an anniversary year. It was just a lot of Superman stuff is going on.
A lot of content.
It's like, hey, come on, you know, you like that movie, come on, read some of our other stuff.
Yeah, but I love this ad. I love the idea of grouping all the Superman stuff you can get in one place. That's cool. Mm-hmm. I loved all
Occasionally,
this.
DC would do that with the Superman ones and the Batman books. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is a lovely ad. I like it a lot.
I so you know when you were a kid in school and they would show a movie in the auditorium, it was like a treat at the end of the year. And so they showed us Superman the movie when I was in I don't know, third or fourth grade, something really young. They showed us Superman the movie, so we're all in the auditorium and we're little kids. And the scene comes on when he's a baby and he's naked. So we all start laughing, right? Because it's a, you know, even though it's a baby, it's still a naked body. So my principal makes the mistake, I've never forgotten this, of going over, pausing the movie to threaten all of us. And he says, you should all, you know, you know, while you are young, you know, he's paraphrasing, but I'm not paraphrasing the last part. He goes, while you're all young, you know, you should be more mature than this. It's just a child's wiener. He says the word wiener. Of all the stupid things to say in a room full of children, and we lost it, and we weren't able to watch the rest of Superman the movie. And so when I was little, my entirety of that movie was right up to the wiener scene until finally I was able to see it later on. Yeah,
I was hoping that was all that you'd ever seen of the movie.
Yeah, that's I was
just
like,
to
man,
this
like,
day, you just have
really
never gotten around to watching
weird naked baby movie. Yeah, I don't know.
that guy's head hit the pillow that night, and he's like, "What am I doing with my life?"
I can't. Well, as a teacher, I was like, "You never." You can say the seven deadly words in Harlem to a group of kids before you can say the word wiener. You can't.
You really did find the funniest way to refer to it.
You can't say that word. I mean, we died. I mean, to this day,
that
I
is
like,
awesome.
Remember just all of us dying. And then, yeah, we all got in trouble and sent back to the room.
Did a mental Rolodex of like Wang, Johnson.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Pallywhacker. I don't know.
Couldn't say pee-pee. I mean, you couldn't, and nothing. Couldn't say anything.
Great. Oh my God. So, okay. There's another, ad.
Transition from that. Kelly.
Yeah, really. From Superman, the movie, featuring an original piece of Joe Kubert artwork. You didn't see Joe Kubert drawing a lot of Superman, but he's drawing Superman from the Christopher Reeve pose where he's pointing into the sky, and it shows you all the different stuff you can get. There's a poster book, a calendar, cutouts, a quiz book, Superman blueprints. And then way at the bottom, it mentions, you can get The Amazing World of Superman, the treasury that they published in 73. Seems strange to me that they're not promoting the Superman the movie treasury, which they just mentioned in the other ad. Like, why that over The Amazing World of Superman? Now, maybe this is a Heroes World ad. It's not a DC Comics ad. Maybe they didn't have that in stock, and I'm sure they had extra copies of The Amazing World of Superman. So maybe that's what it was. It just seems curious to me, but it's a spiffy ad. I love the film strip. It's a nicely designed.
I did end up getting a copy of Amazing World of Superman right around this time. So maybe it was re-released.
Oh yeah. I don't know. Maybe it makes sense. I'm sure it was around, you know, to cash in on the mania of Superman, but it's a nice, again, for an ad that's so copy heavy.
Oh, it's super heavy.
It's, you know, it's nice. And of course the Joe Kubert drawing of Superman is terrific.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, yeah, it is. It's very busy, but it is really cool. I mean, the only thing I struggle with is how could a kid possibly write in that little box?
The same thing,
how do you fit it all? Yeah. How do you fit it all in there? There's no way.
Name of book. Like imagine
yeah, quantity,
some
name of
scrolling.
Book, price. I mean, you know, I and then what is it like? P and A each total. I bet you they did not get as many ads as they thought they would, or they got things in the mail and they're like, what?
Yeah, try imagine a kid with a crayon trying to write Superman quiz book in that tiny little space. You know,
they did not give kids a lot of space.
Yeah, yeah, I would have loved to have seen some of the stuff that came into the Heroes World. And Dover, New Jersey, home of the Joe Kubert School. Okay, so next up, this again, another ad they realized they did not need to really go heavy on the copy. Superman versus Spider-Man. Show the cover. This says it all. Reserve your copy. Yeah, that's it. Done. We don't need to show anything else.
It's amazing. Yeah, I love the pink background. I'm a sucker for an interesting choice in color background, and I love it. I think it's cool. I mean, that cover is just, is it Ross Andrew?
Yes, Ross Andrew.
God.
And Dick Giordano, I believe.
So speaking, I know we were talking about Irv Novik, underrated, you know, Batman artists earlier. Ross Andrew has got to be one of the most criminally underrated Spider-Man artists. I mean, he is, you know, if I think for many of us, one of the definitive, he carried that book in the 70s. He was amazing.
He's who I think of first. I mean, that's because he was the Spider-Man artist when I started reading Spider-Man regularly back in the 70s.
I don't think anybody had a better command of anatomy Mm-hmm. Probably maybe JLGL, but really, I mean, Ross Andrew could draw a figure in any space, in any direction, and it looked right. And
that's this cover is disorienting, right? Because they're, you know, you're tilt, the buildings are tilted, and Superman's flying one way, and Spider-Man's kind of coming in from the other angle, and I mean, it's visually just unbelievable,
right? If you oriented the buildings the way you would, as if you're on the ground, Spider-Man is basically sticking straight up, perpendicular against the building. Like the only thing that's keeping him from falling off the lattice work there is his sticky Spider-Man feet. That's it. Like that's, you know, pretty gutsy, especially if he's about to be pounded.
Oh yeah.
By Superman. But yeah, they just knew we didn't need to sell anything more than this. It's Superman versus Spider-Man. Done. Come on, kids. Well, send in your 250.
You were saying anatomy. I mean, Spider-Man is wiry. He's, you know, thin, where Superman is, you know, huge and, you know, yeah, it's awesome. It's amazing. It's such a great visual.
Yeah. Speaking of, again, great ads, this is an original piece for Superman versus Wonder Woman, and it features a black and white top secret photo of the battle featuring an inverted Superman S, by the way. He's like a yellow S. Gutsy to not do color for this. You know, they wanted it to look real, like it was a black and white photo that like some, you know, camera took, or like a spy took. It's kind of a conceptual piece of an ad. I think it's terrific.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it took me a hot minute to remember why it was taking place in World War II, but that was probably when the Wonder Woman TV series was, where they were, because this was on probably released at the same time as the TV series, and that first season when they were in World War II. So
yeah. Which, wait, was that when she was sleeping with Lyle Wagner or when she was sleeping with Lyle Wagner's son?
What a weird flex that show took in those later seasons.
What a bizarre, it's so, no, this ad is fantastic. I do like, there's just moments in where you can see that comic book companies are trusting their readers more.
Yeah.
Where, they really are. They're saying, like, I don't know if it's through feedback they're getting or they realize that their audience is aging and growing up with them a bit. But I think this is one of those moments where they're like, hey, we can do something that's more interesting and we'll get more eyes on it than just a straightforward ad. I think it's really cool.
Yeah.
Although I do remember wondering when I first saw this ad long, many moons ago, I was like, why can't Superman get along with anybody?
Yeah.
Super dickery.
He's it. Yeah. Right. And yet they never did Superman versus Batman. I mean, you know what I mean? Nowadays, that fight is all the time. But back then, I guess it would have been ridiculous. Because
I think that's just called
Batman.
The 90s.
Yeah, right, exactly. And you know, back then, it would have been like, what do you mean? Superman could take Superman out and Batman out in one punch. But nowadays, of course, it'd be they'd fight to a standstill with Batman winning at the end. Next up is, of course, the first collaboration between DC and Marvel ever, which is The Wizard of Oz, MGM's Marvelous Wizard of Oz. And I don't know why... Very heavy copy heavy, mm-hmm. excuse me. I mean, again, probably a little bit of a hard sell. Hard to remember in this age what a big deal Wizard of Oz was. It played on television every year. That was a big event. I don't know why I'm so charmed by this, but I just love that original drawing of those two little kids flipping out about the comic. I just find that so charming. These little nerdlingers like, oh, look, Wizard of Oz.
But they're looking at a map of Oz. I would have been all over that myself.
That is pretty cool. I think these are those two kids who created Superman in that one issue. they're reality warping powers. They're like, now to Oz. I do have a question. Why is this a Marvel DC joint? Why did it have to be?
They both were working on it simultaneously, and like Marvel had the rights to the movie, and DC had the right to the book or the something. They both just realized, you know what, we're going to be killing each other with competing Wizard of Oz projects. Why don't we just do it together and we'll sell more copies? And that's how. Now it's essentially a Marvel book.
Yeah.
Because it's a Marvel creative team at the time and stuff like that. But it's, you know, yeah, but I think that's really what it was, is that they both just realized, you know what, why kill each other over this? You know, I mean, so let's do it. And so this is the first ever collaboration between the two companies.
The cover is great. I mean, it really captures the spirit of the movie. Did you guys ever read any of the Scotty Young Wizard of Oz stuff from about 10 years ago? The art is gorgeous, and it's, you know, it's based on the books, and it's unbelievable. He's such a talent, and that was a perfect marriage of his style and content. It was great.
I love in the coupon, there's a little gag there. It says, I enclose $2, which includes postage and handling, in check and money order, and I promise never to pick on little dogs. Solid promise to make.
Very nice.
For little kids to make. So, yeah, it's a very nice ad. So, okay, I couldn't avoid it entirely. Rudolph, yep. The red-nosed reindeer. Hands down or hoofs down, DC's biggest treasury star. I think he headlined like 8 treasuries. Superman had like 7. Batman had like 5. So, I mean, they obviously sold a lot of Rudolph comics. And here they talk about there's a poster you can get, 8 pages of puzzles and games. I find this very interesting in that, you know, as superhero comics were taking over more and more, there was still this strata of kids that were buying Rudolphs.
Or, I mean, or their grandparents buying that for their grandchildren because they knew it to be safe.
Yeah, that's true. Probably. Yeah. I mean, you knew it would be fine because it's a Rudolph collection. And I mean, and in fact, they were going to do one more Rudolph treasury and then they repurposed it for a digest. So, I mean, they have Rudolph, king of the formats, you know, so.
And those have never been reprinted either, right? I mean,
no. I think there's some weird rights thing. I can't imagine who, like, somebody has the rights to Rudolph.
That would you would think that somebody somewhere would be able to release, if not DC, somebody would just take that and sell a bunch of hardcover collection of these Rudolph stories.
The book ran for like 80 issues or something. It was a long run. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how many stories are there to tell? Like, I feel like it's a limited window of, you know, farm animal or, you know, wild animal with light up nose. I just don't know how much range there is there. You know, did he have an anatomy lesson? Like, did he have his dark period?
Well, that's the Rudolph Summer Fun where he goes to New York. That's
there you go.
Well, there's that stretch where he was with the X-Men too. So.
Yeah, I mean it's sort of bad. It's kind of funny in this ad that they're promoting the poster more than the comic. It's the poster is the biggest thing in the image.
I just think they were still figuring out, and maybe it's not on them. Maybe it was the reality. Maybe they just had a wild swing of an audience. You know, they had the Roy Thomases who had, you know, grown up with them and were adults collecting, and they had the little kids who were still, you know,
yeah. Yeah, they wouldn't have. Out. They would it's not have kept charming, them. Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah. No, I'm. It's. I'll say if DC put out a hardcover collection of a Rudolph treasure, I'd buy it.
Yeah,
because I want these things to keep going. So yeah, but it's strange. Yeah, Rudolph was big. Then there's another ad. This is a half pager. The new DC King Size Collector Series. This is before they came up with the word treasury or decided they're super size. Brings you the complete origin of Tarzan of the Apes in one magazine, plus many surprise features, which means we haven't figured out what else is going to be in there yet. Watch for it. And it's got a little inset of Tarzan beating the crap out of a chimpanzee. So, you know, kind of amazing how much King Size is doing all the work here. It's a giant 40-point type, and then a tiny, Tarzan of the Apes. But, you know, they figure the art is enough to sell. So it's a handsome little ad, you know, maybe a little too many fonts, but it's cool looking.
And wasn't Tarzan like the third treasury? I mean, even before
that. Yeah, early on. Yep.
Before even Batman. So, it's Kubert's art, right? I mean, it's definitely worth that in itself makes the king size format worth it.
Oh, they're great treasuries. We've covered one of them. Brian Hyler and I did one. They're really solid. DC had put a lot of money into Tarzan, and obviously Tarzan was a big seller because he actually had 2 titles at one point. And Tarzan had his own digest as well. So, I mean, you know, he was kind of a big deal. And then, of course, when DC lost the license, Marvel took it up.
Yeah.
Yep. So, I mean, you know, for a while, Tarzan was still kind of a big, hot property. I don't know who has him now. I'm assuming it's some company has the rights to him at this point. Probably Dynamite or something like that. But no, this was a big thing. But this is this little half-page ad. Again, you know, not a whole lot going on here, but it's nice that Tarzan got some ad love.
I wonder if you don't think he's in public domain yet?
I don't think he is. No, there's some weird thing where, like, some stuff where, like, the original book can be, but the character is not. Or
oh, it's like the Winnie the Pooh thing that's happening.
Yeah,
right.
Right. It's some sort of weird. Yeah, it's a very strange kind of thing. But yeah, there's some solid DC books for these Tarzan comics. So, and then finally, our last ad does not even feature a treasury pictured in any way, except for at the bottom a little blurb because this is the We don't rest on our laurels, but boy, yeah, DC really knew how to do ad copy in the 80s.
Oof, yeah.
And it shows all these covers of all the various comics, including Iraq, Son of Thunder, and All-Star Squadron number one. And then, and coming this fall, Batman versus the Hulk, a spectacular event. Don't miss it. And it's a damn shame they obviously didn't have any artwork.
Yeah.
To show, but, you know, okay. And then it says the new DC where the action keeps on coming. That's a better phrase than we don't rest on our laurels.
It is. Yeah. This is the we're second, we're number two, but we tried harder.
It is. It really is. No, it's, yeah, it's the, you know, well, we're not uppity like those Marvel guys.
Yeah, it's okay. Admittedly, we don't have X-Men, but we still got Teen Titans. I mean, even Teen Titans is kind of buried in the back of
that's,
that.
Okay, yeah. That's my question for you guys, is the choice of the order of the books. Because at first I'm like, okay, Arrak is up front. I guess they're going alphabetically. But they're
Iraq and All-Star Squadron are the new books.
Yeah, they're the new books, and they're probably Roy Fresh.
They're both Roy
over,
Thomas, yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Coming over. So they're probably, in a way, thumbing their nose at Marvel saying, look who we got.
Yeah, it's strange to me, though, because I was like, you know, you would think Titans was a big seller, Legion was a big seller, Justice League, but...
Was a the...
Yeah, no kidding. I do have a couple of questions. I love these ads, though. These are my favorite. I would pore over these ads when I was a kid and try to see if I could find all of these comics.
Yeah,
And then over the years, you know, as it was easier to find comics and I had more, you know, discretionary income, I would track all of those down. I have a question. So Dial H for Hero, Adventure Comics is right behind Arrak. And I did an episode with Professor Allen years ago on a Dial H for Hero issue. We got in a big argument. I think there's an age limit on when you can submit a Dial H for Hero idea to DC. And I think that age limit is 18. I think if you're over 18, you don't do it. And he was saying everybody should be free to do it. And I was saying, no, if you are a grown-ass man, you should not be submitting, you know, Poppy the Polyp Girl to Dial H for Hero. So do you guys think there should be an age limit on that?
Well, I mean, I'm sure it was a really intriguing T-shirt that you won if they decided to steal your IP. But, I mean, the spirit of it is that, and that it would be a child entering it. I figure that if you're old enough, you had a character idea, you might put together your own comic.
The issue we covered, there were a bunch of them from people who were like 35, you know, in their 30s. And I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm okay.
Then again, yeah, you know, you run with what you got. Chance.
That's true.
Yeah, I think the spirit of it suggests that you're supposed to be a kid.
I do too. That's what I thought too. I thought you should have left some room for the kids, but I don't know.
Okay, Wildcat submitted by Jay Lee.
Like, yeah.
Okay, 35 might have been the youngest. I mean, we don't know.
That's true. You're right. There might have been some interesting ones. Okay, I have another question for you guys. You've got all of these issues coming at you, and you only get to buy three. Which three are you buying?
Ooh.
Justice League of America, All-Star Squadron, probably Legion of Superheroes.
What about you, Rob?
Is it is there a dollar figure I got?
No, just you get any three.
Okay, Justice League of America, All-Star Squadron, and World's Finest.
Okay. I'm going All-Star Squadron, Teen Titans. I mean, it's Perez and Wolfman. I can't pass that up. And I'm struggling because I want to get it's Legion or Jail or Batman. I think I would have gone Batman. Yeah. Okay. Even though they bury them in the back.
I didn't include Batman versus the Hulk because he's not pictured.
No.
If that was pictured, I would have included it. And it's a shame because that's the last ever DC Treasury. And strangely, it never got its own ad. They never did an ad for Batman versus Hulk, which is baffling.
That is weird.
Yeah, this is it. This was the sole time it ever got mentioned in a DC comic in any sort of ad. That makes no sense at all. But
that is weird.
Yeah.
Did it sell well?
I guess it must have. I mean, but at the same time, it was the last Treasury ever. Couldn't have sold too well. They would have kept doing them. But no.
Well, they also, I mean, when I picked it up, it was in the paperback book format.
It's been reprinted in lots of formats and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Baffling to me that an all new Treasury featuring Batman versus the Hulk did not get an ad to itself. That makes absolutely no sense at all. But
because of that story, whenever anybody's fighting the Hulk, I'm always like, kick him in the solar plexus.
Fill the room full of gas, kick him in the stomach. That's going to work. The gut. So.
That's what you do. That's how you beat him.
So we don't rest on our laurels. Not a great tagline, but that was DC at the time. So those are the DC ads. Boys, thank you so much for coming by once again. These are always a blast to do. There were so many more to even pick from, but I try to find some of the more interesting ones and the kind of like as different from each other as possible. So guys, again, just thank you for doing this. This is always fun. I love talking, as much as I love talking comics, I love talking ads for comics. That's just so much in my blood.
Yeah, this is great. Thanks for having us. I mean, and this is a fun bookend between, you know, we did Marvel last year, DC. I guess we're up Valiant next year or Image.
There are lots of non-DC Marvel treasuries, but good luck finding ads for any of them.
Yeah, that's true.
I have seen one ad for a non-DC Marvel treasury, and that's an ad that Greg found. For Buck Rogers, the Buck Rogers treasury nice. That they did.
I guess we're going to have a really short third episode.
Yeah, just talking about that one ad. That's it. Then we're out, everybody. But anyway, guys, thank you so much. These are so fun to do. So before we sign off, why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Greg?
You can find Sean and I in the never-ending reading pile. When we eventually get around to recording, we'll discuss a random comic one of us has talked about, one that we've wanted to talk about, and we might have another show in the pipeline.
Ooh.
Yeah, we Never Ending Reading Pile. It's on the Pulp to Pixel Podcast Network. It's fun. It's pure nostalgia. We've done like 17 episodes, and I think 10 of those episodes were from a comic from 1987, which we didn't even plan. And it's pure nostalgia, and it's a lot of fun. I also co-host the Bat Pod with Bill Beer, and you can find me on the All-Star Squadron podcast with Barton Gray and Billy Delicious, and that's a lot of fun too. We get to talk about JSA and Earth 2 and how Crisis crushed Roy Thomas's dreams. But thanks again for having us, man. This is a blast.
Oh yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, except I just as we mentioned in the Marvel show, like these ads were just as much part of it as the treasuries themselves, of seeing these things. And you know, DC didn't spend a whole lot of time in, you know, advertising like single issues kind of thing, and they really kind of exemplified these were special, you know, and you could order them in the mail unless it's that one Batman and then you're out of luck, but generally you know, it was kind of a big deal. So yeah, I love doing these shows, and so again, guys, thanks so much. So everybody stay tuned. I'm going to run some podcast promos, and when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Do you remember your first comic book? Do you remember the first time you held a cover in your hand and you flipped the pages, you read the adventures of these amazing heroes, and you really fell in love with the medium? The first time you bonded a character to a team, to a company, and you knew, yep, I'm in this for life? Well, so do we. So join us on the Never Ending Reading Pile from the Pulp to Pixel Podcast Network, where we proudly don our nostalgia goggles, we dive into our favorite comics, our favorite eras, our favorite characters, our favorite creators, and we just bask in the glory that is being a comic book collector. Come join us and help us chip away at the never-ending reading pile.
The Long Halloween. Hush. Dark Knight Returns. The Killing Joke.
These are all Batman stories that have been talked about and talked about countless times over the years.
They are considered classics, and in most cases, that title is fitting.
The thing is, Batman is nearly 8 decades old, and whilst those stories are worth talking about, there are plenty of other Bat comics that are being a tad overlooked.
And that's where we come in. Hi everybody, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Andrew Leyland.
Andy and I decided that it was a crime that there were so many great Batman stories out there that weren't getting their due.
To that end, we started a show, the Overlooked Dark Knight, a non-index index show.
Our goal is to talk about the previously mentioned Overlooked stories and tell you why they're worth your time.
The show comes out twice a month, with the first episode focusing on the Bat books from the late 70s and early 80s. We're starting with the Len Wein run and working our way forward through the books written by Jerry Conway and eventually Doug Mensch.
On the second episode of the month, we'll dig into the various adventure comics that were based on the Fox Kids / Kids WB Batman animated shows, because they're really good and hardly anyone seems to remember that they exist.
The show can be found at the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network, which is located at www.fortressofbaileytude.com.
The Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show.
Shining a bat signal on the bat stories that no one seems to remember or care about.
Because somebody has to.
Now it's time for listener feedback, and these are the comments we got from our website, findwaterpodcast.com. On the last episode of Treasure Cast, which was episode 69, Shazam, with my special guest, Chuck Dill. First up is Chris Franklin, of course, from our network, who says, great discussion on a comic that was for many years a holy grail of mine. I saw this cover featured in those full-page ads of all DC's treasuries or tabloid editions, and even as a small kid, I knew it was the guy from the TV show. A few years back at the Lexington Comic Con, I found a decent copy for $10, and I couldn't pay the guy fast enough. Jackson Bostock was a great Captain Marvel and, 70s hair aside, looked just like his comic counterpart. Moreover, he had that unquantifiable attribute that few superhero actors possess, to not look awkward or weird in the suit. No offense to John Davey, who replaced him, but when Michael Gray transformed in the opening credits and it wasn't Bostwick, I died a little inside. I was so hooked on the cover, I don't think I've ever read the stories inside yet. I usually enjoy the Fawcett Marvel comics, so I need to do that tonight. Oh, and if you can find it anywhere, I try the Filmation 80s cartoon again, Rob. It does skew a bit more towards the wacky Fawcett material. I mean, there's Uncle Dudley and Talkie Tawny in it, for one. Some early scripts by Paul Dini as well. I did not know that. Thank you, Chris. He continues. Captain Marvel, Savannah, and several other Marvel family members were set to appear in the Challenge of the Super Friends, but Hanna-Barbera realized they didn't have the animation rights of those characters. Filmation did. Oddly enough, Hanna-Barbera somehow got the live-action rights by this point, so they did include Captain Marvel, Savannah, played by Ernest T. Bass himself, Howard Morris, and Aunt Minerva on the Legends of the Superheroes specials. I'm going to have to check out Chuck's toy collection. Sounds like I have a kindred spirit. I've seen that Shazam cereal bowl, and it's beautiful. My family picked me up a 70s little golden book with art by Kurt Schaffenberger recently. It's gorgeous. Next up is Edo Bosnar, who says, oh man, the talk about the show and from the photos in it in your image gallery really brought back Saturday morning memories. Personally, I recall Shazam and then Isis coming on earlier than noon, maybe 11 a.m., because by noon, some of those other live-action Saturday mornings shows that started airing, like, say, Run, Joe, Run or Arc 2. But yeah, I remember that that once the live-action stuff started, it marked a transition in programming, although I recall at least one channel maintained the kiddie material by airing some midday movie matinees. Anyway, if the weather was nice, or even if it wasn't, that was usually the point when my mom, tired of seeing me glued to the TV since about 7 a.m., made me go outside. As for Bostock versus Davey, I remember always liking the former better and finding the transition jarring when I was a kid. But looking at photos of them both now, I have to say that Davey, with his rounder face and beefier build, had a greater resemblance to the Captain Marvel as drawn by C.C. Beck. Oh, and one more thing. I'm pretty sure Otto Binder's surname is pronounced with a short I, as that is, it rhymes with hinder. Otherwise, great show as usual, gentlemen. My compliments to Chuck. Yeah, thank you, Edo. I know that Otto Binder's name is pronounced Binder, but every time I see it, I just say Binder. I don't know why. Matt Saroy says, great show, guys. I always look forward to a new Treasury Cast. This was a blast from the past. I forgot that I owned this one back when I was a little tyke. When I saw it in the gallery post, it all came rushing back to me. In the late 70s, I only knew Shazam from the live-action show. I actually thought this Treasury Edition was an adaptation of the show. It was several years before I learned he had, in fact, originated in comic books. The creative team behind Captain Marvel slash Shazam truly knew the recipe for fun comics. Captain Marvel is a rare example of an innocent and wholesome superhero. On a semi-related note, did you know that Marcia Brady dated both TV's Billy Batson and TV's Peter Parker? Neither one lasted long. I guess they couldn't live up to Davy Jones. That is that's an amazing data point. Thank you so much, Matt. Rob McCarthy says, Filmation's cartoon did a fairly faithful retelling of the first Black Adam story. I did not know that. Maybe I was being unfair to the Filmation cartoon because I have not seen it since back in the days when I worked at the video store and we had episodes from it on video cassette. And I think I watched them or put them on in the store, but maybe I need to give the show a second chance. Maybe even for an episode of Saturday Morning Fever. Who knows? Martin Gray says that well done to Chuck for a great debut. I don't have this treasury. It sounds like a winner, especially the business with the witch. I did see the ads for it as a kid and certainly get the impression it was a photo cover. I wonder if the reason comics didn't do photo covers very much was that they were pretty naff. Remember Babysitter Captain Marvel in the Infinity comic? Either we would get someone dressed up and looking all wrong or an illustrated title character against a photograph. Superman had a few of the latter. I was also confused as a kid by Dr. Savannah's two sets of children. I could read Roy Thomas, Beauty and Magnificence, by bringing in Captain Nazi as their real dad. Too New 52, I fear. The main problem I had with the four kids was that the ugly ones were evil like their dad, while the good-looking ones were good. Bad message. Yeah, I was trying to get that across in the episode, Martin. I'm not sure that I did, so thank you. He continues, Kurt Schaffenberger did occasionally draw himself into Silver Age DC stories. He was very natty. The original last half page of Captain Marvel Adventures 100 was similar to the one in the Treasury, with Cam thanking the readers for their support and holding that issue. Thank you for the information, Martin. Paul Kahn, of course, from our network, says, great episode as usual, Rob, and welcome to the world of podcasting, Chuck. Rob got me into it a couple of years later. I have my own show now. Great insights. This cover stood out in the stands for sure, and all of us are suckers for photo covers. Very true, Paul. Lizanne Oswald says, impressive podcast, most impressive. The cover looks cool, and the TV show was fun enough. The costume does look close enough to the comic, though I definitely enjoy the Levi movies better. Plural? I haven't seen that second one. Do you have an insight on that, Lizanne? Mike Dinas says, there were lots of fun to listen to, everyone. It was great to hear Chuck and his experiences with this Treasury. As I mentioned before, I never got the Treasuries, but with Captain Marvel being my favorite character, I knew this. And the other two Shazam treasures existed, but getting them now was unfortunately very expensive. I grew up with the cartoon and the DC series, and don't forget the Superpowers figure, and even had the Viewmaster reel. But sadly, never found the TV show. Maybe it was just bad Canadian programming. You guys did a really good job tackling these stories. I love them so much for their wackiness and, more importantly, fun. Let's see Superman talk to an anthropomorphic Earth. And it was great to hear you guys emphasize the fun, and hopefully this leads to more Captain Marvel fans. Well done, everyone. Keep up the great work. Thank you, Mike. And then finally, Brett Young says, I have to admit, I'm not much of a Captain Marvel Shazam fan. So as a kid, this particular Treasury edition never interested me much. But looking through the pages Rob posted, it looks like ridiculous fun. I love the image of Captain Marvel revving up to punch the shit out of the Earth. Yes, I know it would be counterintuitive, and the story is ahead of its time regarding preservation, but it's a great picture. Plus, now I can finally cut out a diorama of Captain Marvel appearing to have lost his keys in Colorado. If DC ever wants to make him really work again, I think Batman Brave and the Bold did it right by leaning into the golly gee campiness Captain Marvel, or Shazam now works best with a wink and a smile. Great show as always, Rob. Thank you so much, Brett. Now that you've said that, I can't unsee that shot of Captain Marvel on the cover looking like he is wondering where his keys are. That's a... Well done, sir. Anyway, thanks so much for the comments, everybody. Really appreciate the feedback. The feedback on Treasury Quest is always very warm and positive, and I really enjoy getting to it every episode. So that's going to do it for this episode of Treasury Quest. Big thanks to my pals Greg Arujo and Sean Ross for coming back and doing the second of the ads episode. I think the Marvel one last year was super fun, and this one was just as much fun, if not more. I would love it if maybe we could do a third of maybe ads for independent Treasury Comics, but those are kind of hard to find. So this may have been it, but anyway, it was great fun, and I love talking to those guys. So again, thank you so much, Greg and Sean, for coming back. So of course, you can find all the back episodes of Treasury Cast on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking treasuries over on Twitter at Treasury Comics. And then finally, if you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Jeff Pollier and Brett Young for their support of Treasure Cast. I very much appreciate it. So that's going to do it. We'll see you next month. But until then, go big or go home.
I'm Otto Preminger. 200 years ago today, Thomas Jefferson left his home in Monticello, Virginia, to return to Congress. He had been home since the first of the year with his dying mother. When he got back to Philadelphia, the 33-year-old Virginian found the mood of Congress changed. Now his radical ideas about independence were acceptable. Immediately, Jefferson was given an important assignment, and he moved to 230 High Street, where he could work comfortably. Said Jefferson, "In that parlor, I wrote habitually. This paper particularly. This paper was the Declaration of Independence. I'm Otto Preminger, and that's the way it was."
These historic minutes are sponsored each night by Shell.